This week we're going to learn a sicha for Parsha Bahar. It's the first sicha that's published in for Parsha Bahar in the volume of 22 of the Rebbe's edited version of Sichos and Lakuti Sichos. This sicha is a collection from several Farbrengens, primarily the Yud-Alef Nissen Farbrengen, the Rebbe's birthday Farbrengen in 1980. And it says also some of the ideas here came from several Farbrengens in continuation of that Farbrengen. And also on Shavuos in 1981, so more than a year later, more ideas were also developed and then brought down into this most amazing sicha. It was published as a edited version of a sicha in 1983. The Rebbe is going to take us on a ride through a variety or a broadened section of about 8 different ideas that he's going to collect from different places in the Torah that will teach us this most amazing theme that we're going to learn now. But before we start, I just want to give the concept in Jewish law called lechatchila and bidieved. Those are the two crucial words. Lechatchila means to begin with. This is the way to do something. Bidieved means after the fact, they already did it, not the initial way that it should be done. But after the fact, we say it's also counted as a mitzvah, and you don't have to redo that mitzvah if you did it in a different kind of way. And he's going to bring us many examples to this. So by the end of the sicha, we'll have a very good comprehension of something has to be done initially in a certain way. And then there's something, if you didn't do it that way, it's okay. Sometimes if you didn't do it perfect, it's going to be totally not okay. You'll have to redo the mitzvah or it won't be counted as a mitzvah done. So we're going to see this in what we're going to learn now. In this week's parsha, it says, regarding the laws of agriculture, when you're going to come into the land of Israel, giving of the Torah was on Mount Sinai, in the desert, only 39 so years later, almost 40 years later, we come into Israel. So we have a lot of laws that's going to be when you get into the land of Israel, you're going to start working the land, you're going to deal with agriculture. Remember, in Egypt, we got our food from the government, where we were slaves, and when we were in the desert, we got the food fell from heaven. So only when we're going to get into the land of Israel, we need to have laws, because we're going to have to start working the fields. So one of the laws is that on the 7th year of working your field, that year is called a Shabbos year. The whole year is a sabbatical year. You have to take off from working the field. The field is not allowed to be worked, and it just has to stay fallow. So on this verse that says Vishav Sa'aretz, Shabbos LaHashem, the land will rest, it will be a Shabbos to Hashem. And this, that meaning that the 7th year, the earth has to rest and no work can be done, not to the field, not to the vineyards, etc. The Zohar tells us something on this verse. We know the Zohar goes through each parsha, tells us amazing insights. And the Zohar says something interesting here. It says that there's the verse that speaks about, in a different parsha, but the verse that speaks about the laws of having a slave, we learned already in the past many times that a Jew that's in a destitute situation and they stole, they can't pay back their money, you're allowed to sell yourself as a slave, and there are certain laws for a Jewish slave. There's also certain laws if you have a non-Jewish slave. So one of the main laws for a Jewish slave is that every 7 years on the year when the fields rest, that's the year. Well, really what it says is that 6 years he's a slave. More than 6 years a Jew shouldn't be a slave. The 7th year of being a slave, you have to let him free. But the Zohar says that the 6 years that you work and the 7th year you let free is connected to the 6 years of your field being worked, and the 7th year, the field being freed from work. And just like you have to be relaxed for Shemitah on the 7th year, so too your slave gets to go free on the 7th year. He makes this connection. We know this law. What happens if you let you enjoying the home where you are working for and you want to stay longer? Then we take the Jew to a doorpost and you pierce his ear. And he has to remember that this ear heard that Mount Sinai, you're going to be a servant to God. And now you want to be a servant to somebody else. Remember, ultimately, you're always a servant to God. That's why you poked the hole in the ear. So that's how you could be. But the law is you should go free on the seventh year. And the Zohar is saying that these two laws are connected. Seemingly, it comes out from this, that what the Zohar is telling you is that it's not the seventh year from when you became a slave. He's saying it's on the seventh sabbatical established year of the fields. That's when you should let your servant free. Well, in this case, it becomes a very well-known question that it's a very accepted law from many places all over from our sages that when does a servant go free? It's not the seventh year of all fields when fields get freed from work. It's the seventh year for your service. After working for 6 years, you have to go free. Not on the seventh year when the whole country and all the Jews rest their fields. So what does it mean that the Zohar is saying that it's the same seventh sabbatical year of the fields, that's the year that the slave should go free? That doesn't seem to make sense. Everywhere else, it could be on the third of the 7 year cycles or the four, whatever. It could be one of those years. And it doesn't make sense, this is what the Rebbe points out, that it doesn't make sense to say that the Zohar is actually arguing with all the other well-accepted halachic authorities that everybody says it means the seventh year of his work. And he's saying it means the seventh year of the field work. So, how could the Zohar say this, or what does it mean when the Zohar says this, that they are connected, the seventh year here. So they're in a mass. So if a guy gets sold in the fifth year of field working, that means he's only going to work for 2 years and he has to go free. What does this mean that the Zohar is saying when everybody else seems to not understand the laws like that? So to understand this, remember this question, put it on the side in the back of your head, and we're going to come back to it soon. But first, he says, in order to understand this, we have to understand some things that we find regarding mitzvahs that we have in the Torah. There are some times that we do mitzvahs. To begin with, remember the word is l'chatchila. To begin with, you do a mitzvah in a certain way. And then there's times that certain mitzvahs, to begin with, are done in a secondary level of performance. As it's explained by many of the later commentaries in the Torah, that this difference between initially doing a mitzvah in a certain way or after the fact doing it a little different, we find this even in laws that are biblical laws, not just rabbinical laws, even in the biblical level of laws, which is a much stricter level of stringency in the laws, and even more, not just that the fact that we find this difference by a biblical level law, even more that not just to some details in a mitzvah that are like a side point, that if you don't do it in a certain way, okay, that side point doesn't really matter. But even things that the side point makes a huge difference, we also find that there's two ways in how to do the mitzvah. And he says, we could bring many, many examples to this. But the father law of all the father example law of all this idea we find regarding the laws to sacrifices that were brought in the temple. And I'll just give you the background to this idea. It's brought down in Gemara Yuma and in other places, this idea. And the idea is like this. It says that the high priest would have to pray for the entire Jewish people. He would have to pray on Yom Kippur. He would have to pray for all the Kohanim. And he would also have to pray for himself. In other words, praying means to get atonement. V'chiper ba'ado uva'ad besai. He has to pray for himself and for his family. He has to pray for himself and for all of Am Yisrael, right? So these are responsibilities. Now, there are three verses in the Torah that alludes to this mitzvah that the high priest needs to take an animal, of his own that belongs to him, and he has to bring that for an offering for these causes. And if it's not his own, it doesn't count as a mitzvah. So the Talmud goes through an analysis of why does the Torah have to say this verse three times? That he brings, v'hikiv aron karban chatas asher loy. He has to bring it from him, from his own money, and not from the community pot of money. Why do you have to have three times the verse? So it says, well, once is to tell you the rule. But then we have to know, to begin with, that's the rule. But maybe b'di'eved, if he brings, he doesn't have one of his own. It comes from Kippur, he doesn't have his own. So he takes an animal from the Kohanim's pile of money. I would think maybe that's okay, because he didn't have one of his own. You would say after the fact, b'di'eved, it's okay. So the verse says, no, it has to be ashalo. Even after the fact, it's not good. It's not counted as an offering. And then if he wants to bring for his own family, for himself, he wants to bring, and what happens? It comes Yom Kippur, the night of Yom Kippur, and he doesn't have, he can't afford, he just doesn't have of his own. So he says, oh, you know what, I'll just take from the community pile of animals. You would think maybe, okay, it's not the best way to do the mitzvah, but maybe it's okay to do the mitzvah like this. So we have another verse that tells you, no, it must be asher lo. So in other words, you see here clearly that in this instance, even after the fact, it's not good enough. In other words, to begin with, it has to be yours, and you can't say after the fact that he did it like a different way, not his, it's okay. No, we have a special verse to teach you it's not okay. But what this teaches you is that if you don't have an extra verse telling it to you a second time or a third time or so on to teach you that, that means otherwise it is okay to do something not the initial way. In other words, even if you did it not the way it was expected, it's also okay. So based on this principle, we'll be able to answer and explain many ideas that are very wondrous, meaning they're like difficult. And some of them he's going to bring down now. So difficult ideas throughout Torah, he's going to explain them here now how we could understand it. For example, let's take something that is a mitzvah that's nowadays. What's the mitzvah that we do every single day now? We count the Omer. Now, the instruction in the Torah regarding counting the Omer, in Parshas Emor, it says like this, Usafartem lachem mimacharas haShabbos. You should count from the day after Shabbos, for 49 days you should count the Omer, and the day after 49 and the 50th day is the holiday of Shavuos. Now, this is one of the most famous cryptic verses. It says, again, let's follow these words. You should count from the day after Shabbos. Now, all of us here remember, when do you start counting the Omer? Day after Shabbos means on Sunday, on a Saturday night or Sunday. The sages teach us this verse does not mean literally from the day after Shabbos on a Sunday. That's not when you start counting the Omer. What it means is the day after Yom Tov. The day after the first day of Pesach, from the second day of Pesach, you start counting the Omer. Actually, there was a group of Jews. They became very popular in the Second Temple. They were like our big, big troublemakers. They were called the Sadducees. Tzaddukim, Baitusim, they're different names. These people, the Sadducees, they had a warped way of understanding things in Torah. Basically, they said that we're never going to listen to any laws in the way the sages interpret a mitzvah. They took every mitzvah in their own hand. They said whatever it says literally in black and white in the Torah, that's the way you have to do the mitzvah. This was one of those examples. It says in the verse, you should count from the day after Shabbos, which means a Sunday. Everybody else said, the sages interpreted this and had many discussions about this with many reasons and logical reasons of why when it says here the day after Shabbos, it must mean the day after Yom Tov, not the first day of the week. And by the way, this makes a huge difference. If you say you should start counting the Omer from a Sunday, that means that Shavuos could come out 5 days later after everybody else is counting. Because, you know, Pesach could start on a, let's say, if Pesach starts on a a Tuesday, let's say. So they say, no, don't start counting the Omer Wednesday like everybody else. Start, you have to wait till Sunday because it says the day after Shabbos. So it messes up a lot of things. By the way, these Saturdays, just as a side note, you may enjoy this. This is one of the reasons why we eat chalent on Shabbos. It's because of these people. These people said that you only follow the laws the way it said. No interpretation of the rabbis. So it says in the Torah, you're not allowed to ignite a fire on Shabbos. So they said that means that you can't have anything with fire on Shabbos. Therefore, they used to sit in the cold all Shabbos. They would not hold of what the sages said. The rabbis interpreted the mitzvah to mean that you're not allowed to start a fire on Shabbos. But not that if you start the fire before Shabbos, you can't enjoy the fire. So they said, because you can't have a fire on Shabbos, says don't start a Shabbos. They said you can't have a Shabbos because that's more literal. So they said that we're going to eat and that we'll be in the cold all Shabbos. We're going to eat only cold food Shabbos. But if you follow the sages, you're allowed to have hot food. And that's why Jews started coming up with these innovative ideas to purposely eat a hot food and purposely when Shabbos afternoon, show that you're not a Sadducee and you do follow the interpretation of the sages. That's just like a side example. There are many examples. But back to here. So the verse says the day after Shabbos, and they said it means literally, but the sages said no, it means from the day after Yom Tov. The question is, since the Torah wants us to start counting the Omer from the day after the Yom Tov of the first day of Pesach, why did the Torah say it in such a funny way? The Torah says it's from the day after Shabbos. And we say Shabbos doesn't mean Shabbos, it means Yom Tov in this instance. Why did the Torah have to say it like that? Why did the Torah give room to people to make such a mistake? To begin with, the verse should have just said, Usfartam lechem, you should count mimacharas from the day after Pesach. The day after the first day of Pesach. Why did the verse say it in a way that there's room to make a mistake? But based on what we said before, we could explain this. Because the idea, there's a difference between to begin with there should be something like this, and after the fact, it's also okay. In other words, there's the ideal way of doing something, and then there's another way how it could be done. Not always do we have the opportunity to do something in an ideal way. The Torah here wants to teach you. The ideal way of doing the mitzvah is when the holiday of Pesach is going to start on Friday night. So Shabbos will be the first day of Pesach. And you're right, you're going to count from Sunday. Day after Shabbos. That's the ideal way. But even the Torah itself tells you, many years it's not going to be that way. Many years the first day of Pesach will not be on a Shabbos. So there's the ideal way, and there's not ideal, but it's to teach you that even if it's not ideal, it's also 100% counted as a mitzvah. It may not be perfect ideal. It's called bidyevet. It's okay, even though it's not ideal. What's the ideal? If Yom Tov would be on Shabbos, and then the ideal way of counting the Omer would be 7 full weeks from Saturday night from Sunday. Now, he says, let's see some examples to this. That there's an ideal way of something, and even if it's not ideal, it's also okay. From the most simple, basic examples is, in the time when the temples stood, on the holidays, Yom Tov, you brought special offerings in the temple. We used to bring special community offerings on Yom Tov. And even an individual would bring special holiday offerings. You brought special animals that you brought that was called Oilas Re'ia. Every person that managed to make it to the temple and got to see the temple, you brought a special offering to represent the opportunity you were able to see the temple. You also had to bring animals called the Shalmei Chagiga, which is one time, you brought this animal one time on the holiday. You brought either an ox or a lamb or a goat, a male or a female. Usually you brought it the first day of the holiday. If you didn't have a time the first day of the holiday, you could bring it the rest of the holiday. The point is that on the time the temple stood, we would bring lots of animals to the temple. When the temple was destroyed, we still have the holiday. but we do it without these offerings. And by the way, even during temple times, if you did not own a piece of land, you did not have to make your pilgrimage to the temple on the three big holidays of Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. It was only if you owned a piece of land. But nevertheless, even when we don't have the offerings, there's still 100% a holiday that you have to celebrate that the Torah tells us to do it. And it's understood that these offerings that you would bring on Yom Tov, especially the ones that you brought when you did the pilgrimage holidays, the three holidays of the feet when we went up, it's not a side detail of the holiday that you brought the offerings. The offerings was an outcome of the holiday. It was part of the holiday. It actually made the holiday complete. Nevertheless, in a situation where we don't have the temple, meaning you can't bring these offerings anymore, according to the Torah, you're not allowed to bring offerings today because we don't have the temple. You still have the holiday and all the holiness of the holiday. So what do you see from this? That there's an ideal way of having the holiday when you have the temple. But even if you don't have it in the ideal level, you still have the holiday proper. So even though, what's the ideal way to holiday? When you can bring offerings. What's the secondary to ideal way? When you still have the Yom Tov, even though you don't have the offerings. More we find, there are some mitzvahs that to begin with, they were given to us in a way that's not necessarily the most highest ideal way. Because you see, there are certain mitzvahs that were given in different times. In one time, you could do a certain situation would allow you to do the mitzvah in the highest way. Certain situations, you wouldn't be able to do it in the highest way. For example, we had Pesach. Pesach and Sukkot, you have the Yom Tov days and you have the Chalamoah days, the middle intermediate days of the holiday. Both are Yom Tov, but you can't compare the sanctity of the first days and the last of Yom Tov to the middle days. There are certain allowances that we could do that are not, because it's not as holy. So you see that even in mitzvahs, even in a Yom Tov itself, there's the ideal days of the Yom Tov. Those are the more auspicious, completely full holiday days. And then you have Chalamoah in the middle days, which are still Mayadim L'Simcha. You're supposed to be happy. There's a special mitzvah to be happy then, but it's still different. By the way, on the middle days of Yom Tov, the Chalamoah, you're allowed to write, even though you're supposed to write a little different, hold your pen a little different, maybe today typing a little different. I think there's leniences to work if you have a loss of money, but on Yom Tov, there's none of that stuff because it has to be full celebrated Yom Tov. So you see that even in the way the mitzvahs were given to us, you have two ways, the most highest ideal auspicious way, and then you have a secondary way, which it's still counted Yom Tov. Now he says, now we could start understanding the way it is by the counting of the Omer. When the verse says you should start counting from the day after Shabbos, even though it means the day after Yom Tov, it's to tell you that when Yom Tov is on Shabbos and you start to count not just the day after Yom Tov, but it's also the day after Shabbos, literally, that's the most highest ideal way. So it's not about you and I and how we do it. Sometimes you can't do it in the most ideal way because the day of Yom Tov doesn't start on Shabbos. Nevertheless, when it does, it's a much more auspicious, complete level of the mitzvah. That means the mitzvah of counting the Omer to begin with was given in two ways. The most ideal way, and you have to do it this way, and to count it the day after Yom Tov. And then there's a way when it's actually both Shabbos, the day after, it's the day after Yom Tov, and it's the day after Shabbos. So when it says in the verse, that's why the verse says it like this in this way, even though there's room for people to make a mistake and interpret this verse wrongly, nevertheless, the verse wants to use this word to teach you that this is the most highest and best ideal way for this mitzvah when the first day of Yom Tov falls out on Shabbos. Now the Rebbe brings an amazing, amazing, wondrous medrash that will illustrate this point even stronger. On this verse that says you should count the Omer from the day after Shabbos, the Medrash says the following. It says you should count the Omer for 7 complete weeks. Sheva Shabbosis Tumimai. 7 complete weeks. Says the Medrash. A Masai Hein Tumimais. When are these 7 weeks called complete weeks? If the two groups that are normally responsible to watch the temple, their names are Yeshua and Shechanya. If those two groups cannot perform their service, then you know that year is the most complete 7 weeks. Very strange concept. What does this mean? So there are the commentaries that explain this medrash and say that it means like this. When you count the Omer from a Sunday, 7 weeks, 7 times 7. That means Sunday to Shabbos, the 7 complete weeks. That's when it could be complete. What does this mean? So the background is like this. The Medrash is giving you a hint to this. When is it possible that the weeks are complete? That complete meaning that you're counting from Sunday to Shabbos, not from Tuesday to Tuesday. So the idea is like this. There were 24, the background is, there were 24 groups, the Chafdal Mishmaris, the 24 groups that were in charge to watch the temple. They would watch, make sure the services ran smooth. They had their duties. Now, they were divided up by families. Now, certain families, every family knew your turn 1, your turn, your week 2, your week 3, your week 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And so on. Now, when the first day of Nisan was on a Sunday, Rosh Chodesh Nisan was Sunday, so the first group, they came and did their job from Sunday for a full week. The next week starts from day 8 to 14. That was the second group's watching. The third group is going to start from the next Sunday, day 15. They're going to start their watching of the temple. And this is the way it would go. Now, 1 second. Sorry, the week of Pesach, nobody had to watch. There was nobody's responsibility. It was a holiday week, a Yom Tov week. Whoever wanted could come there, but it wasn't counted part of your turn. So the first week of Nisan, second week of Nisan, Pesach's always on the 5th day of Nisan. So on the 16th day was Sunday, that's right, you start. And then the third week is Yom Pesach, so nobody watches. So then the fourth group would start watch. The third group would start the week after Pesach. Now, how many weeks do you have for Omer? 7 weeks. The first week is on Pesach, so you have 6 more weeks. So you had only 6 weeks plus the first 2, so you had 8 groups. The time it came, the holiday of Shavuos, 8 groups did their job. So the group 9 and group 10, Yeshaya, Yeshua, and Yeshechenya, those two family groups, didn't have a turn to do it before Shavuos. If Rosh Chodesh would be in the middle of the week, so there would be a different group, would be the first few days of the week. The next group would start from Tuesday till Shabbos. Then the next group starts like that. So then there would be an opportunity for group 9 and sometimes 10 to also have a watching group. So the Medrash is basically telling you, if you don't have, when is it 7 complete weeks that you started counting Omer on the 7, if these two family groups did not do their watching between Pesach and Shavuos. That's how you know, that's the hint, to know that it's, if it's a complete year or not a complete year. The verse says you should count 7 complete weeks. What's a hint to know if it's complete? It's complete if Yeshua and Shechenya don't have a turn to do it before Shavuos. Now, the Rebbe says, we have to think about this. Something's not making sitting well. The obligation of being complete, of counting it complete, is every year. Every year. As we know, everybody has to count 7 full weeks, no matter what day in the week you start. As a matter of fact, if you miss one day of the Omer, you can't count anymore if you forgot one day. If you missed by night, you could start by day without a bracha. Then you could, you know, if you miss one day, you could continue counting the rest without a bracha. But it's a serious thing. Then why? Why can't you count anymore with a bracha? Because you don't have 7 full weeks. You missed a day. So why does the Medrash say that when is it counted as 7 full weeks? Only if it started on a Sunday? Why is that called complete? It could be 7 full weeks for all, like all of us do this year. And even more, you're giving room to these Sadducees, to their opinion, God forbid, to say that the counting has to always be from the day after Shabbos. By saying that it's only counted complete if it's going to be from the day after Shabbos, so then you're saying what the Sadducees are right, that it should always start just on Sundays, the day after Shabbos. So what does the Medrash mean there when it says this interesting idea that how do you know what's complete? Only when it starts on a Sunday, because then these two groups don't have an opportunity. So how do you explain this? It's like this. When is the week's complete? Meaning complete like the first 6 days of creation. Meaning very complete. 100% perfect. If it starts on a Sunday, that's when it's 100% completely. But even if it counts during the week, it's still complete, but not perfectly complete. In other words, it's not the most ideal setup of a holiday to start during the week, but it's not bad enough that the whole mitzvah doesn't count or you can't do the mitzvah. You could still do it. After the fact, in other words, b'di'evit, the fact that it starts like this, it's okay. That's an amazing understanding here, because this is the novelty of this idea here. You could say something is complete and 100% complete, and then you could just say it's complete. So if it starts on a Sunday, it gets the name Shlemus. It's literally complete, 100% complete. Otherwise, it's complete. Like this year, we're doing it complete, but you can't say it's 100% complete because it's still missing the component of having the solid full week like that's from on a Sunday. So in other words, the greatest level of completion is when you have it the way the 6 days of creation was, from a Sunday, Tuesday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's the highest level of complete. So what do we have from all of this? That the Torah sometimes speaks about a mitzvah, how it is at the highest level in every single possible detail, but it also leaves room that if it's not the 100% perfect ideal, it's still also 100% okay. This gives us now answers to us something else that we have at the end of the Omer. Let's understand a little bit how this works. You're counting the Omer for 49 days. Then, what's on the 50th day? Shavuos. Now, today, it's hard for us to understand this concept a little bit because today, all we have is a calendar. We don't anymore have where witnesses go to the court, to the Beit Din, and they say, oh, me and my friend, we were standing outside, we saw the new moon, and they cross-examine us, and they announce that it's Rosh Chodesh. Today we're working with a calendar system, so everything is preset. But in the time of temple times, or as it's called, Bizman Hara'iyah, or Alpi Hara'iyah, the times when the day Rosh Chodesh is, were set by how you see, if you saw the new moon. It could make a difference in what day of the month is the holiday of Shavuos. By the way, the only holiday of the year that could be sometimes on one day of the month, sometimes another day of the month, is Shavuos. Pesach is always the 15th day on the Hebrew calendar. Sukkot is always the 15th day on the Hebrew calendar. Yom Kippur is always the 10th day of the month. Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the month. Even Hanukkah and Purim, by the way, are also. Hanukkah is the 25th day of the month. Purim is always the 14th day of the month. They're set days. The only one that could change is Shavuos. Why? So let's think for a second. If you're counting 49 days from the middle of the month of Nisan, what's going to be at the end of the month of Nisan? Is it a 29 day or is it a 30 day? So let's say Rosh Chodesh is established to be a 2-day Rosh Chodesh. In other words, Nisan is a 30-day month. And what if the next month is also a 30-day month? Then Shavuos is going to come out on the 5th day of the month of Sivan. What happens if 1 month is 29 days and 1 month is 30 days? Then Shavuos is going to be on the 6th day of the month. What happens if both months are a 29-day month? Shavuos will be on the 7th day of Sivan. Because Shavuos is only going to be the 50th day after the first day of Pesach. It's day 50. So day 50, it depends how you got there. If Nisan had 30 days and Iyar had 30 days, right? So Shavuos is going to be the 5th day of the month. That'll be the 50th day. So that's very unique about this holiday. But what that means is, when you think about it, that Shavuos, some years, in the times when we used to establish the dates based on coming to the courts, that means sometimes Shavuos was not on the same anniversary day that we got the Torah. Most opinions hold that with the year we got the Torah, it was on the 6th day of Sivan. If some years Shavuos could be on the 5th day or the 7th day, that means it's not going to be on the day that we got the Torah. It won't be the actual anniversary date, which is very unique. Some opinions say that Shavuos could have actually happened on the 7th day, fine. But if it's the 5th day, for sure, everybody agrees that that was not the anniversary date. So then we have a question, a big question. Our sages connect Shavuos with the day of getting the Torah very, very serious. As a matter of fact, you're going to really appreciate this one. It's a fascinating thing. You know, every Yom Tov, we take out an extra Torah. And we read one paragraph that recites the offerings that were brought. But there's one small difference on the holiday of Shavuos. It says, each one of these holidays, it says, you should bring one goat, Seir Izim Echad, one goat, a he-goat, Lechatos, to be an atonement. But on Shavuos, it doesn't use the word to be an atonement. In other words, sorry, it says it should be for a sin offering. That's the correct word. Seir Izim Echad Lechatos. It should be for a sin offering. But on Shavuos, the verse switches the word sin offering, and it says you should bring this he-goat for an atonement. Doesn't say for a sin. The Jerusalem Talmud says that this is very precise. Obviously it's precise. We've learned many times that even the smallest nuance in the Torah, especially a big one, is a big thing. It says, you know why? Because Shavuos, we don't need any atonements for sin. We didn't do any sin. And not just if we did a sin or not. The Talmud says like this, when God came to give us the Torah, he loaded us with so many mitzvahs, and we accepted it. So God says, look, I burdened you so much to accept all these mitzvahs. Even if you sin, I'm not going to count it as a sin. You're atoned right away. Amazing idea. In other words, it says, since you accepted the Torah upon yourself, Mailani Alechem, I accept upon myself you as if you never sinned in your whole life. And therefore, it's an amazing holiday, Shavuos, because nobody's a sinner. We're considered to be sinless, flawless. But how do we explain this? Shavuos is so connected with the giving of the Torah, but sometimes it could be that the holiday of Shavuos should happen on a 5th day of the month, which is not even the day of the giving of the Torah. What's going on over here? Is the holiday so connected with the Torah, but then some days it's not on that date? How could you have the holiday not on the date when the Torah was given? So to explain this, he says, what's the whole idea of the counting of the Omer? Counting of the Omer is preparing yourself to get the Torah. As many of the early commentators say in the name of the Medrash, that it's because of our yearning, our strong desire of the Jews. We've been counting every day. We're so excited for this day, right? You ever see somebody count down for an amazing, exciting holiday day or your wedding day? But this is our wedding day with God. We're counting down with such a yearning. From the day we left Egypt, we started counting. How many days is left to get closer and closer to the giving of the Torah? The 49 days of the counting are the preparation. And as it says in Chassidus, through counting the 49 days, which is corresponds to the 49 levels of the gateways of understanding things, you can reach then the gate 50, Shar Hanun. When you reach to that level 50, that's the level of proper comprehension of Torah. So it's like a moving up ascending scale to get to day 50. Comes out that even though the idea of the counting could be established in a way that it should be the 50th day, but it doesn't must fall out actually on the day itself. In other words, the ideal day level is when it falls out 100% on the same day itself of the giving of the Torah. But even if it's not 100% ideal, it's still okay because it has the accomplishment of our work for 49 days. Because the main thing is you reach to the level 50. Meaning you reach to the level where it doesn't even say in this holiday the word sin. Because the fact that we accept it upon ourselves, everything, it's as if you don't have any sins. So this is another place where we see this idea that you can have the most ideal level is when the holiday falls out on day 50, which is also the sixth day of the month of Sivan, meaning it's also exactly on the anniversary day that we got the Torah, because that's really the whole theme. But nevertheless, even if it's not 100% ideal, it's still good. Then he says we could go even another step. Let's explore another idea. In mitzvahs itself, you could find one mitzvah that you could perform it in two different ways. The most ideal way and secondary to the most ideal. For example, the mitzvah to remember that we left Egypt. The same mitzvah, to remember that we left Egypt. We have it in two ways. You have the mitzvah to remember that we left Egypt on the night of Pesach, how you remember it there. And then you have the mitzvah the rest of the year. We all know the difference, by the way, simply. The night of Pesach, you say the whole Agada. You're supposed to elaborate on the whole story. The whole year, you just have to mention it. That's it. You don't have to go into this whole elaboration of it. So you see, this in one mitzvah, you have the most ideal way, which is on the night of Pesach. And then you can have it, not the perfect ideal, but it's still a full, complete mitzvah. Obviously, the night of Pesach, that's when we left Egypt. That's why you have to do it in the full highest level. The rest of the year, it's just remembering it. It's an outcome of the day that we left. So it could be done a little bit different, not so high the for most perfect ideal level way. Now, this idea that the same mitzvah could be done in two ways, most ideal and a little bit less than most ideal, like the mentioning of the Exodus of Egypt, he says we find a Mishnah, which is, at first glance, it can knock us off your feet. It's tamua b'yoser, he says. It's amazing, wondrous kind of Mishnah, what this Mishnah is saying. The Mishnah says like this. There are those people, the Mishnah in called Shkolim, and over there, in the beginning of the fifth chapter, it says there, it lists out the people, the family people, or the people that were in charge in the temple. Basically, they had to put their seal on certain stuff that it was belonged to the temple and it was holy and so on and so forth. And these names, the Mishnah actually mentions the names of these people. It says, for example, Yochanan ben Pinchas, he was in charge of the seal that went on it. And different people were in charge of different roles of confirming things. And the commentaries explain, when it says the names there, that you could explain it in two ways. Either you could say it was the most kosher people of every generation that was appointed to be the people that we could trust, they would sign off. Or you could say it was whoever was in that generation counted. They were in charge for their generation. Doesn't that mean necessarily the most kosher of them? But the Rebbe says, let's get to the basics of this. Why does the Mishnah have to tell me the names of these people who did it? As the expression is, L'may nafkamina. What does it make a difference to me to know the names of these people? Who did it the generation before? Why does that help you? Or as the Talmud says many times, says, my dahava hava. Whatever happened, happened. Why is, what's got to do with us? Why do we people now need to learn the Mishnah and know these names of these characters? How does that help us? So the Bar Tanura, right? Not just the drink. The Bar Tanura is the name of the commentary on the Mishnah. And he says that the reason why these people were accounted, were listed out, their names, who they were, because there was something in their names. And therefore, actually, he says, every person that got this position after the first person died, we started to call you with that name of whoever, of the position that you took over. Question is, why do you call the next person that's in row taking care of somebody else's position? Why are you calling him with that name? Imagine this guy's name was, what did we say? We said, Yochanan ben Pinchas. Okay, so now he dies. The next guy, we're going to start calling you from now on Yochanan ben Pinchas. Yeah? What is this? What are we doing here with these names that are so important to know them? And not just that, everybody from now on gets these names. So the Rebbe says, you have to understand what it means, names. The name of somebody tells you the nature, the characteristics that lies behind there. And I want to share with you a story. The Rebbe brings down that the sages tell us a story that Reb Meir Havadayik Bishma. He was very careful in names. What does this mean? He was very careful in names. So let me just, since he brings in the footnote, you know, where it comes from. So let me read to you the story. In the Tractate of Yuma, in page 83b, it says like this. Reb Meir was once traveling with his colleagues, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. They needed to stop off in a hotel. And Reb Meir was very careful. He would read into things when he would hear a person's name. But his colleagues of Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, they weren't so particular in what the guy's name was. So they pull into this hotel and they asked from the person, place where they were lodging, they said to him, what's your name? You hear Zelig the story. They asked him, what's your name? So he says, my name is Kidor. Reb Meir hears this and he says, ooh, this guy's a bad guy. Psh, he thinks to himself in his head, bad stuff. This guy's a real Russia. He says, Kidor, Kidor, Kidor. That's the beginning of a verse that talks about bad people. It says, Kidor tapuches hema. That they are a generation, Kidor, they are a generation of bad people that turn over things and they make them really bad. And these are people that we have no trust in them. A verse in the book of Deuteronomy talks about a generation of Jews over there that'll cast aside their religion in that they were raised with. They're very bad. They cast away everything. They have no values of real things of God. They're not God-fearing people anymore. So Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi said to themselves, I trust this guy. I don't care what his name is. Looks like a nice, trusty guy. They took out their purses. It was Friday night. It was Friday afternoon. And they said to the owner, Kidar, Mr. Kidar, can you please hold my purses and our stashes of values? Reb Meir wouldn't trust this guy with his stuff. So where should Reb Meir put his values of money? So behind the inn, there was a cemetery. And Remeir scouts around there and he sees a tombstone that was the father of Mr. Kedar. So Remeir takes his stash of money and he puts it right behind the head of the tombstone of this Mr. Kedar's dad who's buried there. Middle of the night, the innkeeper, Mr. Kedar, has a dream. His father comes to him in a dream and tells him, come take the purse that's lying by my head. The innkeeper wakes up and he sees these couple of rabbis and he tells them over the dream. Now, Remeir didn't want this guy to go out because he'll see his purse there. So Remeir said to this guy, he says, you know, he says, Friday night dreams mean nothing. Don't pay attention to them. He brings down the commentary say because it makes sense, actually. The sages don't lie. But it makes sense because Friday night, you're not thinking about business anymore. Your mind is much more relaxed. So you're much more open to wonder your thoughts. And that's what Remeir is telling the guy. Like, don't pay attention to, you know, a dreams of Friday night. In the meantime, Remeir goes out to the cemetery and he guards his stash of money. Can't touch it. It's Shabbos. But he guards it the whole Shabbos until after Shabbos. After Shabbos, he takes back his purse. The next day, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, they go to the owner and Mr. Kedar and they say, could you give us back our purses? He says, purses? I don't know what you're talking about. You never gave me a purse. So Remeir said to them, why were you not careful to pay attention to his name? I told you pay attention to names. Why didn't you pay attention to names? So they said to him, well, why didn't you tell us that we can't trust this guy? So Remeir says to them, well, when I said that one should be particular about names, I meant only be suspicious and worry about these such kind of people. But I never told you should establish him as a bad guy, but I told you, you know, watch out. So these two rabbis, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, they took the innkeeper and they said to him, listen, come with us to a store. We want to buy you some wine and some drink, you know, come with us. So they took him to this inn and they saw, when they came into the inn, all of a sudden they saw on his mustache, they saw some lentils there. He had some, you know, leftover soup from his house. You know, some lentils were on his mustache. So they ran to the guy's wife and they said to her that your husband told us that we should tell you that you should give us back our purses. And he told us that we could give you a hint that you should believe us, that it's true. He told us to tell you that he gave us the secret what you guys ate for dinner or for your meal and you had lentils. So the woman said, ah, obviously it's true. It's true. The story is true. I had lentils. So she went and she gave it to her. She gave it to them, the purses. When the man came back, he was so mad at his wife and he killed her. And the Talmud finishes with this story. It says, from this instant, it's well known something that was taught in a brisa. And it says that first, the washing before a meal, first washings, if you miss washing before a meal, it could lead to eating pork. And if you don't wash your hands after the meal, it could lead to kill somebody else. And the commentaries explain that there was once an innkeeper who, not an innkeeper, a guy that owned, like he took care of the food in an inn. And it was during a time when there was a decree that you were not allowed to serve only kosher food. You had to serve, you know, non-kosher food too. So this Jewish owner started to sell both foods. He had kosher counter and he had also pork. Normally, you're not allowed to have a business of pork. But it was a dangerous situation, so, you know, you could, you're allowed to have business if it's dangerous. So he put the, he would look around when customers came into his restaurant, he would see if you wash your hands before a meal, he knew you were Jewish. Because Jews wash for habotzi. One time, a Jew came in. The commentaries debate if the guy was secular or what it was. It didn't care about the rules or didn't know the rules. Bottom line is, the restaurant owner didn't know that this guy is a Jew. So he served him the pork. So that's what it means, that if you miss washing before a meal, it could possibly lead you to end up eating pork. And what does it mean that if you miss washing after the meal, you could end up killing somebody? That's the story that we just said. Because if he were to wash his hands after the meal, he would do what most men do with their wet hands as they start touching their mustache. So he would have taken off his lentils. And because he didn't take off his lentils, they knew what he ate. They were able to go to his wife and they gave the purse, right? So that's that story. But what's the famous thing about this story is the line that Reb Meir was medayik bishmei. Remeir have a dayik bishma. He knew how to be very precise about names. Now let's go back to our sicha here. You appointed people to take in charge of the temple, these certain names. That's because we needed to have people that their names give away their characteristics. And therefore, that's emphasized in their names. And therefore, every generation, when they had to appoint people to be in this position, they had to find people that are fitting for this name. But the fact that we found people to appoint later who had a different name, but we gave them the same name of the first guy, it's understood from here that it's only you're like that first guy. We're calling you with that name because you're like that first guy, but you don't really have this name. Ah, so what do we see from here? Again, another proof to the concept that there's the ideal thing and then there's not so perfectly ideal, but it's okay. We see this by the names, even in a Mishnah. So in other words, normally if you read this Mishnah, you probably couldn't fall asleep because why in the world would the Mishnah tell you names? But now you understand. If you were born with this name, so you were born with the most ideal characteristics to take this position. But if not, and you match the characteristics, so we gave you the name. But giving the name to you is not the same like you actually have that birth name, the name from birth. So again, this illustrates the same points that we're bringing out the whole time in this sicha, this point here. So let's just recap these few examples that we gave, and then we're going to see the amazing answer and tie in the whole thing. So we gave an example of the most 100% ideal in situations. We said in temple times when you were able to celebrate holidays with bringing the animals, the offerings in the temple. That was the most 100% ideal way of celebrating the holiday. When the temple is destroyed, we can't bring the offerings. It's still a good kosher Yom Tov, but it's not the most 100% ideal. Then we said in holidays itself, there's the more ideal days, which is the Yom Tov. The less ideal days is the intermediate days, the Chol HaMoed. Then we said, when the verse says that counting the Omer is the day after Shabbos, all that means is that that's the most ideal way when the counting of the Omer starts on the day after Shabbos on a Sunday. But even if it starts the day after Yom Tov in the middle of the week, it's also 100% perfect counting the days of the Omer. But most ideal is when it's actually also on starting from a Sunday. Then we said fourth example was sometimes Shavuos lands on the fifth day of the month, sometimes the sixth day, sometimes on the seventh day. Even though the Torah was given on the sixth or the seventh day, sometimes it could be on the fifth day because the most ideal day for 50 would be on the day when we actually got the Torah. But it's also okay, sometimes it'll be on the fifth day. Then we gave an example of a mitzvah. We said that the mitzvah of mentioning, remembering the Exodus of Egypt, the most ideal is the night of Pesach. But all year round, you still have to mention the Exodus of Egypt too. Then we said the people that are appointed in the temple and they have certain names, yeah, the most ideal is if you're actually born with that name. But even if you're not, we'll give you that name, it's also okay. So from all this, you see that is the most ideal, and then you have not the most ideal, but it's still counted 100% as a mitzvah. Now with this, we're going to be able to understand what did he mean, the Zohar. Let's go back to that question you had in your head the whole time. When the Zohar said regarding the seventh year that you're supposed to leave your fields fallow, this sabbatical year for your fields, that's the seventh year. So he said that for an individual person, if you're a slave, a servant, then the seventh, that's also the seventh year for being freed from your work. Why? He says, because there's something that's also in this category, most ideal and secondary to most ideal. Since every individual Jew is part of the makeup of all of Klal Yisrael, of all the Jewish people. Now the difference is, the seventh year is the seventh year for sabbatical for your field. That goes for all Jews across the board. That's the year that the whole year should be a Shabbos for you. That's 100% the most ideal. And that's when you have all the laws of the sabbatical year. But in a year that's a seventh year for you as an individual, it's like a seventh year of a sabbatical year. Therefore, you should go free. So in other words, what the Zohar is telling you, that the most ideal setup is, if for this servant, his seventh year is also the seventh year of the whole Klal Yisrael. It doesn't mean that every time, if it's your third year of slavery, you're going to go out free. But what it means is that there's the most optimal idea. The most optimal way is if the servant's seventh year as an individual also in line with the seventh year for all of the Jewish people resting. That's the most optimal. So this is an amazing novelty idea. And the Rebbe says we actually have to delve into this and look in the books, in the holy books, that on a year that's a seventh year for a servant, that's also on the year of a sabbatical year, that it should express itself that you should, that you're going free in the highest level. And we have to understand what's really the difference at the end of the day. But it's just showing you that there's the most optimal ideal, then there's also okay. But now we understand this Zohar, what he's trying to tell us over here, that he's trying to tell you that this would be the most complete, highest level for a servant to be free if it also worked out the same time there. And based on all this, we understand what the Torah says, that the day after Shabbos we count, that's because that's when it would be the highest thing, and that's when it would be the seventh year to free a servant there, would all be the most optimal thing. So this is the concluding of this Sicha, and I would think, I mean, everybody could take the lesson, you know, that you see for you to take fit, but I think we could take a simple thing is that when we do mitzvahs to Hashem, which we all try our best, we try to do things on the most highest level, the most optimal, 100% complete level. But even if you don't, and you don't manage for whatever reason, sometimes it's in your control, sometimes it's not in your control, as we brought some examples here today. Sometimes it's just the way it is. We don't have the temple, which could be in our control. But then you have things like mentioning the, you know, the Exodus of Egypt, or if the 50th day is, you know, starting from the middle of the week, not on the Sunday. So it's not always in your control. But nevertheless, we should understand that even if it's not done 100% the highest level, it's still a full, complete mitzvah. And don't be down about that. L'chaim.